Good day, everyone, and welcome to this press briefing on the status of foreign aid in the funding debate. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions, and you may enter the question queue at any time during the conference by pressing star 1. Please note this conference is being recorded. It's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Mark Lotwiss, Senior Director of Public Policy at Interaction. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and welcome to this media briefing. I'm Mark Lotwiss, Senior Director of Public Policy at Interaction. As you know, Interaction is the largest alliance of U.S.-based non-governmental international organizations with over 190 members, and our members operate in every developing country working with local communities to overcome poverty and suffering by helping to improve their quality of life. As we approach a time when Congress considers the FY fiscal year 2012 budget, the first thing we must recognize is that the poor and vulnerable around the world don't have a lobbyist in Washington. Interaction, my colleagues on this call, and nearly 200 other nonprofit organizations around the United States and the world act as the voice for hundreds of millions of people when these decisions are being made on how much help we can provide during these trying economic times. And I want to point out first and foremost that the American people support doing the right thing to help the most vulnerable. Polls and other research show very strong support among the American people to vaccinate children around the world, which has been shown to save millions of lives, provide clean water and sanitation, teach sustainable farming practices, provide access to basic education for children, and to treat HIV/AIDS, amongst many other priorities. They also strongly support a vigorous response to humanitarian crises like we've seen in the current famine in the Horn of Africa, Haiti, and Japan earthquakes, the tsunami, and so on. In addition, we must keep in mind that the international affairs budget supports U.S. jobs through helping develop markets around the world. And we must note that 95% of the world's consumers live out of the United States, and that's where we need to go, is where the consumers are. The international affairs budget also supports our national security. And so what I want to do, and I'll stop there and introduce our panelists on the call today who will address these areas and many others and any questions that you have. So first, I'd like to introduce Monica Mills, the Director of Government Relations at Bread for the World. Second, Mike Breen, Vice President at the Truman National Security Project. Third, Tom Hart, Director of Government Relations at the One Campaign. And Paul O'Brien, Vice President of Policy and Campaigns at Oxfam America. So I'll ask each one of them in turn to introduce themselves and give a brief statement, and following the statements of our four panelists, we'll open up to questions from reporters. Monica, would you like to begin?
Yes, thank you, Mark, and good morning, everyone. Bread for the World has been working on budget issues really for about the last 6 months and following very, very closely all of the work with the Budget Control Act and now the consequences of that, which Congress are focusing on right now. And this afternoon, there is a markup in the Senate Appropriations Committee on the Labor H bill, the transportation, and what we're all very interested in is state foreign operations. The faith community has really come together to work on this. You may have been hearing some about this circle of protection, but we believe that budgets are moral documents, and how we work on the budget and what we put into the budget are really moral choices. We believe very much that the nation must reduce future deficits, but not at the expense of hungry and poor people. We really believe that this debate has a moral dimension, and as Christians are asking how we protect the least of these. And I think that there is a lot of work that we have done to support these programs as they relate, as Mark said, both to economic development issues and to security issues, but there is really a part of Americans and that will be discussed in the polling about why this is important for Americans to do from a moral standpoint as well. So the faith community is behind really keeping a strong funding and as high as possible for the Senate mark in poverty-focused development assistance in the 150 account so that we can use that for poverty-focused programs. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thanks. Yeah, this is Michael Breen from the Truman National Security Project. And we, along with many of our coalition members, approach this from several standpoints. One, of course, being the moral angle that and the key set of moral obligations that have already been mentioned. And I think that goes straight to our national character. But this is also a crucial set of programs for our national security. And I think, you know, the point can't be made too often that, especially when it comes to national security, sound strategy has to drive our budgetary choices. Our short-term arguments about the budget cannot drive our strategic choices for the next 10 years if we are going to protect America and protect its citizens in the way that we must. And the strategic environment, the world that we face, that we confront, is a hyper-connected world. I think we all understand that. For the last decade that we've been facing that hyperconnectivity, we learned on September 11th that events in poverty-stricken villages in Afghanistan can alter the skyline of Manhattan. But we cannot unplug from this world. We cannot unplug from this interconnectivity because the jobs that will be created that will take us out of this recession and the American prosperity of tomorrow will be built on a global economy and in a global marketplace. And that means that our future prosperity and our national character both demand that we remain engaged with the world and that we greet the world with a full set of national security tools. Those tools include the traditional, you know, elements of power such as intelligence and military, but they also include the crucial foreign aid and development programs that foster a true global stability that is based on hope, human opportunity, and freedom. Now more than ever, we need these programs to create the kind of stable world that we want to live in and that as Americans we can be proud to be leaders in. The Arab Spring in the Middle East has unleashed forces, an entire new generation of young Arab leaders takes to the streets and North African leaders takes to the streets to really seize control of their own destiny. And in order to be successful in building their future, they will need the kind of support that only United States State Department, the USAID, the Agency for International Development, that only they can provide. In Iraq, we are currently experiencing the largest transfer of authority from military officers to civilian officials, development and diplomacy officials, that we've seen since the Second World War, with much of the future of the region hanging in the balance in that transfer to civilian agencies that must be well-resourced in order to succeed. Around the world, the members of this coalition and our government agencies and U.S. government programs are on the ground providing crucial health care, but also providing a crucial early warning system that allows us to detect and deal with pandemic diseases of the future before they reach our shores at the speed of a jet airliner. These are crucial national security programs. They're absolutely essential tools to have in a balanced toolbox as we greet the new century. And I think that any short-sighted cuts to these programs, which are already weaker than they need to be from a funding standpoint, will hurt us strategically in the next decade. And with that, I'll turn it over to our next speaker.
Hi, this is Tom Hart with the One Campaign. Thanks for everybody for having joining this call. I think I'm going to be the statistics guy, so I want to just share a couple of things. So much of the debate around foreign aid circles around public perceptions of foreign aid, or perhaps more importantly, politicians' perception of their constituents' ideas on foreign aid. So we went out and asked the American public earlier this year about their perceptions of foreign aid and came back with some interesting stats. Some are familiar to all of us. Some were pretty interesting. We talked to 1,200 likely voters with an oversampling of Republicans. And three big points. One is in most national polls on foreign aid says, do you want to support increases or support decreases? No one ever asked, do you want to keep it relatively the same? And we found that around 52% of the public, even while they think that we spend vastly more on foreign assistance than we actually do, even with that misperception, 52% want to keep it the same or increase it. About 45% said that they wanted to decrease. Once you tell them that the fact that it's less than 1%, the shift is remarkable. those who want to decrease drop by 20 down to just a quarter, and with nearly 75% saying that we ought to increase or keep the same our commitment to foreign assistance. And third, and again, this is a truism on so many issues, but it's so true on foreign assistance too. When you ask the American public what they think of foreign aid, they don't like it. When you ask them if they like immunizing kids, providing clean water, educating children, providing people with who are hungry with food, support across the board from all parties across the nation soars above 75%. So again, we need to do a better job of not labeling these things foreign aid, which feeds into people's misperceptions about writing blank checks to corrupt dictatorships, but actually talk about what our assistance actually does and how much room, or more accurately, how little room it takes up in our federal budget. Armed with those two facts, the American public really does support their politicians maintaining or even increasing our current commitment to life-saving programs. Where I think this misperception played itself out most dangerously is on the House side, House of Representatives, where earlier this year they passed legislation which would provide pretty steep cuts, particularly in the overall state and foreign operations bill, but particularly to the development programs, poverty fighting programs. And just a few quick statistics, there was about almost a 20% cut to the development accounts, which if you just look at our assistance to helping hungry kids, would result in nearly a million children not receiving nutritional supplements, which lead to early stunting. And again, when you begin to humanize some of these statistics, some of these facts and figures to the most vulnerable people on the planet, these numbers matter. And as we're looking at a crisis in the Horn of Africa right now, it's even more important, I think, to recognize that our assistance can make a world of good, but also when we are not stepping up to the table, it really does have a direct human impact. Turn it over to others.
Hi, thanks. This is Paul O'Brien at Oxfam America. We are an agency that does both advocacy and programming work. We don't take U.S. government funding. We joined this group of 129 organizations who are showing unprecedented coordination on this because we're very worried about what's going to happen over the next few days in this discussion. And so we want a deep public discussion around what's at stake. Things have gotten worse for the global poor in recent years. We have a billion people who are hungry. We know we're going to have in the range of 9 billion people by 2050. We've got plenty of food, but we've got to have a global system that distributes it fairly, and that's what good and thoughtful aid can help do. It's not sufficient by any means, but the U.S. over the last few years, really the last 3 years in particular, has sort of realized that it needed to modernize itself to step up to this challenge. So there's been a whole bunch of reforms that have happened. I'll mention a couple of them, but all of those reforms are in jeopardy with this budget debate because the first money that's going to get cut is the good money that's doing the far-sighted development. And the money that's going to get saved is potentially the money that will focus on more the short-term emergencies, both political and otherwise. And that's worrying if it's about dealing with the political right now. So just let me say a little bit about why I think this is good for the U.S. economy. We know we're in an environment where folks are worried about what's going on at home, but as we heard from Tom, they also care about our global standing, and from Monica about American values being shared broadly. But economically, there are good long-term arguments as well. Half of U.S. exports now go to developing countries. And these aren't big American corporations. These are 95% small and medium-sized American businesses. We believe, and so does USAID, that for every 10% increase in exports, there's a 7% increase in U.S. jobs. So that over time, if we can open up these markets, if we can create new consumers for American products, it's in our long-term interest. But that argument has to be front and center, and it has to be something that the politicians care about. So why do I think these reforms first, why are they so important and what's at stake? A lot of the reforms that went on over the last few years, including like new initiatives like Feed the Future, the Global Health Initiative. What they're really saying is, how do we take a systemic approach to these problems, work with other donors, help countries to help themselves, and spend our money much more cost effectively than we used to? Because we're never going to have enough aid dollars to simply feed everyone and give health care to everyone. But how do we actually get this better coordinated? I lived in Afghanistan for 5 years, where I watched USAID be essentially blind on the ground in 2002 and 2003 because they had so few people, they couldn't listen, they couldn't engage, they couldn't see what was going on. Over the last few years, they've built up some of their capacity, so they can actually save money. Instead of being a pass-through for contractors, they're able to get out there, have conversations, and spend their money much more cost-effectively. If this budget agenda ends up eviscerating all of those reforms, we're going to leave our development agencies handicapped again, just at the time when global issues are rising once again to the fore. So that's really at the heart of our concerns. I can say more about what Feed the Future has done, which is a lot, but I think the key message to take away is that they're trying to find much more cost-effective ways to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars on helping the global poor.
Okay, well, I want to thank our panelists and now open up two reporters for questions, and so we'll poll and see if we have any questions at this time.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your phone. You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key, but once again, star 1 to ask a question, and we will allow a moment for any questions to queue. We do now have a couple of questions. We will go first to the site of Susan Cornwell with Reuters. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if you know yet any of the details of the Senate markup. I understand that their top line number is I think about $5 billion higher than the House markup. So that's a considerable amount higher, and I suppose it would mean that there's hope for some of the accounts that you're concerned about. But I wondered if you knew anything on that yet.
Hi, Tom from One. Do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So what we expect, and the little bit that we've heard, is encouraging that indeed while the House took a small allocation and prioritized the security parts of the State Foreign Office bill and underinvested in development, that the Senate version rebalances that in a way that I think we will find encouraging. I think that, as you pointed out, the the Senate allocation is about $5 billion higher. It is fairly close to current FY11 spending, and so our expectation is that many of the accounts we're looking that we prioritize will be relatively close to current spending. That obviously is not what our ambition is looking toward, but it is far better than trying to manage cuts.
And I think the other thing, this is Monica at Bread, I think the other thing to take away from this is that it's moving in the wrong direction. And particularly as Paul stated, these numbers of global poor are at a time when they're going up because of food price crisis and food price spikes. I think that it is just the wrong direction for these dollars to be going. We're very, very grateful that the Senate mark was not lower than it was, and that hopefully through the conference process it won't go down closer to the House mark. But we are all very aware, and which is why, as Paul mentioned, what is new really is that there are 129 signers to this open letter that was in yesterday's in Monday's paper. Will run again on Monday, but we're very, very concerned about these numbers.
And this is Paul O'Brien. Just to add to that, I mean, our core concern here is that the House number was in danger of shifting the negotiating range at the wrong time instead of working within where the precedent of where foreign aid should have appropriately been at. The number they came in with was so low that having a $5 billion difference in this year is not anywhere near as comforting as it would have been in previous years, because we fear the whole negotiating range has been shifted southwards. Well, southwards is the wrong way, downwards.
And this is Mark Lawless from Interaction. I would also point out that, you know, we took a significant cut already in FY11, so that using that as the sort of baseline, you know, this community and collectively what, you know, the United States has supported to do has already taken a very significant cut. So, you know, while the Senate number is certainly better for us at the moment, as Monica said, this trend is in the wrong direction.
And just point of fact, the amendments that we have heard about have thus far would not affect funding levels. They're just policy issues.
Right. But I think going back to what Paul said earlier about the policy pieces, things like Feed the Future and some of these programs were really attempting to coordinate in a better fashion of how the aid is delivered and to use those dollars more effectively. And if those programs like that are not going to be able to be funded, it sets us back again. And so one of the things about using our dollars more effectively, you have to invest in some of these kinds of programs.
Next question, Mark?
Yes, I think let's take the next question.
All right. We will go next to the site of Ivy Mung Kao with DevEx.
Yes, good morning. I know we're talking about the fiscal year 2012 and ongoing budget debate, but there's also these on debt ceiling deal earlier this year, and we have this super committee right now who's trying to find more savings in the federal budget. What do we know of the foreign aid budget cuts that this committee may be considering, and what do you have to say about that?
Tom or Paul, would you like to address that?
This is Paul. I mean, first, if you're talking about, is it a $1.5 trillion target that we're trying to hit, the key thing is to go back to Tom's numbers. The size of the foreign aid bill is not going to get you anywhere near achieving significant movement on the debt ceiling. When you've got a security cap stipulated in the bill at $684 billion, and we're talking about, you know, in terms of pure poverty assistance funding, less than $30 billion going to foreign fight poverty overseas. It's just not significant enough at a global budget level to make a difference. It is, however, for the 1 billion people living in poverty and on $1.25 a day, incredibly important.
Just a brief addition to that, I completely agree. If the super committee ends up making further cuts to state foreign operations and foreign assistance, they will have failed in their task. Their task is to deal with the non-spending side of the ledger. If they fail, or Congress fails to pass their recommendations, then we face real jeopardy, as do all discretionary spending programs in the federal government, and including our own.
Monica, would you like to add anything?
No, I think it's been well said. But they have a huge task ahead of them, and we're focusing right now, this coalition is focusing right now on the FY12 appropriations process, and it's in real time because the markup is this afternoon. And the super committee is just beginning its work. I know that they will move very, very quickly, but our first focus for right at this moment is the appropriations process.
Okay, next question.
And at this point, we have no more questions in queue, but once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1. That is star 1, and looks like we've got somebody else popping up now. We will go to the side of James Mamnion with AFP. Please go ahead.
Hi. You were saying earlier that the Senate appears to have redressed the balance between development and security aid. But I was wondering if you could sort of lay out what proportion of the aid is development aid, what proportion is security aid, and as specifically as you can, what the differences are between the House and Senate versions.
Hi, Mike from Truman. Could you address that question?
Sure. I think the crucial point here really is that the development funding, as you know, these 150 accounts have been, and I think rightly so, considered by Congress, both House and Senate, to be national security programs. So they are in the national security bucket, if you will. And so the full range of development aid programs, and that includes both U.S. government programs and support that U.S. government agencies give to NGOs doing crucial work abroad, that is all now very rightly considered part of national security spending, along with intelligence, homeland security, the Department of Defense, and other programs that fit into that bucket. And the reasons for that, I think, are clear, which is that these programs, as we've said, are the right thing to do. They are a key part of our national character. They are an essential part of the future of the global economy, and they keep us safe. And so Congress, recognizing that, has placed these programs in that security bucket.
And so that's how they've redressed the balance? By sort of re-describing the programs as being national security as opposed to development aid?
Are you referring to the balance between sort of hard national security spending? And
yeah, I mean, you know, I believe that what you were saying earlier is that the House took its biggest cuts out of preserve the national security programs, but took big cuts out of development aid, right? And that in the Senate, they've added money. And as a result of that, there's a better balance between development aid and national security money. But what I just heard you say, I mean, I may be misunderstanding you. I'm not familiar with the technicalities here, but that one of the ways they've done that is by sort of reclassifying development aid programs as national security programs. Would that be right?
I think it's right to say that they've reclassified basically the entire State Department, USAID budgets. All of these budgets have been in total reclassified as national security programs, in a sense, especially for purposes of deficit reduction in the supercommittee. But that's true across the board. To the extent that, and it's important to be very clear that that has not redressed, and I don't want to say that that's redressed, imbalances between the Department of Defense budget, say, in the United States and the State Department's budget.
I mean,
much more broadly, we have a very unbalanced set of budgets by orders and orders of magnitude. Former Secretary of Defense Gates was fond of saying, I think still is fond of saying, that there are more people in military marching bands than the State Department has diplomats. So we're dealing with a massive imbalance in resources between hard military tools of national security and diplomacy and development programs that I argue and that General Petraeus has argued and Secretary Gates has argued are equally essential for our national security. So classifying the 150 accounts, classifying the State Department and USAID as national security programs is one step, but the funding imbalance and the resource imbalance between, tools of military power, and I used to be a military officer, so I understand how important those tools are, but on the flip side of that, redressing the imbalance between military spending and State Department USAID spending, we're nowhere close to redressing that balance.
Mm-hmm.
Can I add to that? This is Paul O'Brien. Most of these are the organizations that you're talking to today. We care about the national security issues, but really our stronger concern is what's happening to the global poor. And we obviously we're making the case that if we do right by the global poor and do development effectively, it's in the long-term national security interests of the United States. But within that broader national security framework Mike is talking about, we're much more interested in the development dimension of that national security agenda than the hard defense agenda or even the diplomatic agenda. And when you have the House proposal, the State Foreign Office proposal cut USAID operating expenses by more than a quarter in their proposal. Basically, what that means is these new staff that they've been trying to bring on to better monitor how they spend their money and to be more cost effective, the whole development leadership initiative, all of those staff would have to get laid off. And folks who are lining up to join USAID because of this Development Leadership Initiative would have to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. When you see cuts to programs, the Development Assistance Account almost cut by 20%. Overall food aid by more than a quarter. It's really a significant across-the-board sort of taking the legs off some of the best dimensions of our development efforts, which we like to think are key for U.S. national security, key for our long-term economic interests, and key, as Monica was saying, in reflecting the best of American values.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things just to mention is that former Secretary of Defense Gates used to say that it's cheaper to the money that we invest in development is cheaper than sending in soldiers, and I think he recognized what a critical component of national security development money is, and how wise that spending is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, do we have another question?
And we have no more questions in queue at this time.
All right. I would like to jump in. This is Mark Lotwiss at Interaction. Just on the last question then, just to point out that, you know, when this national security bucket has been created, that the international affairs portion of that is about 7%. Defense is about 81%, Veterans Affairs 7%, and Homeland Security 5%. So the entire international affairs is only 7% of the national security bucket total, if that is helpful. So do we have, if we don't have any other questions, I'd ask if any of our speakers had any remaining points that they would like to make.
We have no questions in queue.
Just a couple of bits of data after, but I hear somebody else was ready to go.
Oh, we have one more question. Is that right?
No, we have no questions in queue at this time.
So this is Paul O'Brien. Just a couple of additional bits of data. Why, you know, what's our foreign aid doing on the ground? Just taking one of these new initiatives, Feed the Future, which, again, is more about reforming how we do business, making sure we're better coordinated. We believe, as a consequence of that, that there are 8 million farmers in the Horn who are now more resilient and don't need emergency assistance. We've seen through U.S. aid efforts at improving agricultural productivity in sub-Saharan Africa, a 400% increase in large locations affecting the poorest farming communities. And last thing I will say, there's a, you know, right now other donors globally and people like the Chinese, Indians, and others, they're all talking about how we're going to solve global poverty by economic growth. And with the reform agendas that have been pushed in the United States, we're now, in a sense, leading a lot of these how to make economic growth work for the poor discussions. We've got the Partnership for Growth and so on in the Presidential Policy Directive, which the anniversary for which, by the way, is today, I believe. It's 1 year today, 1 year ago that President Obama announced his Presidential Policy Directive. And in that started the Partnership for Growth to focus on how we make growth work to fight global poverty, bringing the private sector, aid, and investment together. Here's the point. If we lose this appropriations battle, a lot of these reforms are going to go out the window, and the U.S. is not going to be leading the global discussion on how to fight poverty in the 21st century.
Okay, thank you. Any other closing points from our speakers? All right, well, then I would like to just make one more point from the interaction side here. You know, as we look at the budget itself and we think about the future reducing deficits and reducing costs to U.S. taxpayers in the long run, you know, it has been shown that the investments made in international affairs are very cost-effective in reducing our exposure as taxpayers to more expensive solutions down the road, which sometimes involve our military both in terms of costs of money and in exposure to people's lives of those serving. And so I think that the second point is that, as was made earlier about expanding markets abroad in developing countries for U.S. products and goods, and I think that, again, as international affairs spending helps expand those markets, you know, we are directly affecting the U.S. economy and creating jobs where people are paying into the tax rolls rather than being a burden on them. So that this small percentage of the national security bucket is contributing both in the short term and the long term to reducing the deficit and is a wise investment. So with that, if there is no other comments from any of our speakers and no other questions, I think we can conclude this call. Is there any other comments that people would like to make?
Thanks, Mark.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank all the reporters for joining us today and thank each one of our panelists. And if you have any further questions, please don't hesitate to contact the respective organizations and their communications staff. We want to thank you very much for your time this morning.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation and hope that you have a nice day.